Rochester, before I go to the studio, I'm expecting Professor LeBlanc, my violin teacher, to come over and give me a lesson. So you better hurry up and shave me.
Yes, sir.
Got everything ready?
Yes, sir. It's all here. Hot water, towel, brush, shaving cream, razor, and plasma.
Good, good. Now make it quick.
Okay. Wait till I get the cap off this new tube of shaving cream.
New tube? What happened to the old tube? There ought to be at least one more shave in it.
But, boss, you've been saying that since 1938.
What?
I didn't mind when you made me run it through the ringer.
Now, look.
And I didn't mind when you asked Don Wilson to sit on it.
Roger.
But when you made me take that tube down to the Union Station and lay it on the track and wait for the super chief, that was going too far.
Well, all right, if you say it's empty, I'll take your word for it. Go ahead, open that new tube.
Do you want me to christen it with a bottle of champagne?
No. Wait a second, Roger. No use opening that shaving cream. Use some of that over there.
This? But, boss, are you sure this stuff is good for shaving?
Certainly, it says so on the box. Does everything. Now, hurry.
Okay, I'll lather up your face. Mmm! Look at that soap foam. Are you still under there, boss?
Yes, and be careful when you use the razor.
Okay, now let me see. Two ears, one nose, one chin.
Two ears, one nose, one chin. Rochester, what are you writing that down for?
After I finish shaving you, I call the roll.
Oh, don't be silly. Now get on with the shave.
All right. I'll put on a little more lather. Come in!
Bonjour, Rochester. Monsieur Benny is expecting me to give him a violin lesson this... Sacre bleu, that looks delicious.
Professor, stop trying to blow the foam off. It's me. Get your foot off my knee. It's not a brass rail.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Now, come on, Rochester. Get this over with.
Sit down, Professor. You're next.
And be careful with that razor.
Yes, sir. Mr. Benny, lean way back and lift your chin up. I want to get your neck nice and smooth.
Okay. Roger, what'd you stop for?
I was just wondering, boss. Do you think this would be a good time for me to ask you for a raise?
No, it wouldn't. Now, take it easy.
Yes, sir.
And as soon as you're through, out! Rochester, you cut me.
It's about time you felt it. I did it a minute ago.
Well, why didn't you tell me?
I was waiting for you to bleed.
Don't be funny. Did you cut me bad?
That's nothing, boss. I just snipped the stem off your Adam's apple.
Clumsy thing. I'll have to buy a collar button. Well, wipe the soap off my face. Thanks. Oh, Professor, I'll go put on a tie, and then I'll come back for my lesson.
Oui, monsieur. Rochester, the cut on Monsieur Benny's throat. Is it a bad one?
No, it's not deep at all. And it's all my fault.
No, Rochester. It was my fault. I didn't push your hand hard enough.
Jack, let's talk about your alter ego, your professional image now. It's an image of a stingy, kind of conceited, rather pompous man, a kind of man that most of us wouldn't like, but you've made him likable for about 50 years. Now, how have you done it?
I'll tell you how. Because I take on all the frailties, I think that's the correct word, isn't it? Frailties of man, all of his faults. Everybody has one of those things, or there's somebody in the family who is stingy, you know, other who thinks he's a great sex man or something, other who think he's... A hero, you know, and they make fun of own people in their own family. So what I think is, I think that certainly people cannot believe that I would be as stingy as I portray the character. But the fact that they think, well, maybe he is a little bit stingy, makes it funny. I want people to think that, you know, even though I'm really not. I want people to think, gee, I bet he's a little bit stingy.
Even people who know you very well know that you are not at all stingy.
Yeah.
They still laugh at this alter ego.
That's right, because they accept what you do on the stage. It's like a fella They may think that Edward G. Robinson, they know is the nicest guy that ever lived, but when he plays a gangster, he's a gangster. So they accept my character as they would in a play. Yeah. You see? If I come out, like my opening lines, I always do something like, I just won $80, you're going to get a great show out of me tonight. You see, now that's a big laugh right away. I always try to find certain lines that they're going to laugh at immediately so that I got them right away. They accept what they are educated to accept by watching my programs year after year, you see.
Year after year, you went on with these tremendous ratings because people knew you.
Yeah.
And they knew all the people who were with you.
And they could see on radio all my pauses. You know, they didn't have to see it visually. They could see it in their own minds. They knew why I was waiting. If Phil Harris insulted me, or Dennis Day said a silly thing, or Mary Livingston made a smart aleck report, you know.
He was nostalgic about those great days of radio, as no, many of us.
But those were kind of nervous days for me because I was trying to uphold a position in show business in those days. You know, while today it's all gone by, I have nothing to worry about anymore. I'm too old to be thrown out of show business. People talk to me about radio, I'm not interested in that. That's gone. I don't believe in nostalgia at all. I don't want to go back. I only want to... It's present and future for me.
But it's
when
different.
People say, we liked you very, very much on radio, maybe better on radio and television, I say, I can't help that. I want to be liked on television.
But do you understand their nostalgia for
Oh,
radio?
Sure, because they could visualize everything. And they used to say, the things you did on radio that we could see that's better than television. But then I turn around and show them some of the things I've done on television that you could never do on radio.
Completely different device.
Completely different device. You couldn't do it. It wouldn't go over on radio, you see. So I wouldn't be interested in it. Because supposing I did the greatest radio show in the world today, all these people that talk about how they loved it wouldn't be listening.
When you started in radio, it was a conviction on your part that it was the road to go.
Oh, when I started on radio. As a matter of fact, in 1931, I quit a job with Earl Carroll's Vanities where I had 20 more weeks to go at $1,500 a week. Now, you know, in those days, that was a tremendous amount of money. Mm. And you travel, you had your expenses paid, you had nothing to worry about. $1,500 a week. Well, that's like $15,000 a day, you know. And I gave it all up just to try to get on radio because I felt this is nothing. Radio is a thing. And I got on it.
It was a conviction on your part.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people in those days were saying that it was nothing very much.
Oh, sure. I knew you have to get in. Then the minute I saw television was important, then I got into television. You see, you have to get in all the new media.
That would suggest that you have a fairly good business mind.
Well, not a financial business mind. I've never been a good financial man in business. I've never known exactly what to do with money and all this and that. I had a good business mind as what's good for me in my work. You know? And the other way, I need an awful lot of help. So financially, if I were a real good businessman financially, I would have millions and millions of dollars like some of the other actors who have it.
Have you ever worried about money?
No, that's the trouble. I never cared about it very much, and that was a problem I had when I was making so much money with very little income tax. Yeah. I didn't know about money. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't care. Nobody helped me. But it didn't bother me. I'm just very fortunate that after a certain number of years that they still wanted me. Otherwise, I could have had a problem. I haven't got the problem anymore.
You believe in destiny? That some are cut out to do things and some are not?
I believe in destiny only as two meanings. One, like fate, for instance. I think fate is another word for accident. I think if a person has a tremendous amount of talent and has the opportunity to show it, they're going to get someplace. That's destiny. There are some people who are very talented, probably who've never had the opportunity. I think you must want to work. You must like your work. I think you must try to learn from other people. I don't mean that anybody can take anybody else's style exactly. It's impossible. But you can learn. We all learn. We're still learning. When I do a television show, I learn something from the Laugh-In program. I learn this. I don't mean that I do things that they do, but I learn the importance of speed, that not to stay too long. Now, we don't do anything like Laugh-In, but because I've done the things that I do like Laugh-In, I've done way before Laugh-In ever was shown. I've done things where you have people come in and do cameos and do short bits years ago, radio, television, everything. But what you learn from Laugh-In is action. Don't drag.
And you believe that there are always new things to learn?
There are always new things to learn. I think people learn something from me. I learn something from somebody else.
It all looks so easy for you. Has it been?
Fairly easy. I think I've had it easier than most of the comedians, but it hasn't been easy as it is now. See, now I know what to prepare and what to do and what to write. I can write for London. I can write for Australia. You know, I know exactly what to do. I can write for Vegas.
But that comes from a lot of experience.
That's right.
A long period
That's
of
right.
time. But did you start out with the idea of being a comedian?
No. I didn't know what I was going to be. I thought I was going to be a fiddler of some kind. And I became a comedian by accident while I was in a sailor show during the First World War, Great Lakes. We did shows. And the author of the shows, the sailor shows, wanted me to read a line once, to play a comedy part of an orderly to an admiral. And he gave me a comedy line to read, one or two. And I read them very well. Why, I don't know, because I'd never read lines before. And he liked it, and he kept embellishing the part. By the time the show opened, I had the comedy part of the show. And that's when I realized that maybe I could be a comedian.
Ladies and gentlemen, yesterday afternoon I went to a lecture on psychology. This lecture covered the particular phase called schizophrenia. As I left the auditorium, I ran into...
Don.
Huh? Oh, hello, Jack.
Don, what are you doing downtown?
I just attended a lecture on schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia, eh? Well, Don, I guess it's all right, but with butter being plentiful again, nobody will use it.
No, Jack. Schizophrenia isn't a food.
Then, Don, why did you go?
Jack, schizophrenia is a psychological subject dealing with dual personalities. You see, everybody has two sides, the good side and the bad side.
Oh, Don, that's a lot of hooey.
Oh, no, Jack. It's true. Everybody has two sides.
Don, you've got four sides, but that doesn't prove anything. Dual personality.
Certainly, Jack. There's a little man inside of all of us that subconsciously governs everything we do. So you see, everybody is really two persons.
Well, you can believe that if you want to, but I certainly don't. Any man in his right mind would... Excuse me, Don.
What's the matter, Jack? Do you have a cold?
Oh, just a little one. Oh, darn it, I forgot a handkerchief. Here, I'll stop in this little haberdashery and get one.
Okay, Jack. I'll wait for you out here.
Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
I'd like a handkerchief, please.
A plain one or something with lace?
Just a plain one, something inexpensive. I already have two of them at home.
Yes. Now, here's a plain little handkerchief for 10 cents, and here's one that's softer for a quarter.
I see. Well, gee, I don't know which one to get. This one's a quarter, and that one's 10 cents, huh?
Yes, sir.
Well, I don't know. I like the looks of that quarter one, and yet...
You know which handkerchief you're going to take, Jack Benny.
What?
You're going to take the 10 cent one. You always take the 10 cent one.
Oh, I don't know what to do. I want the quarter one, and yet...
You know what you're going to do, Jack Benny. You never bought a quarter handkerchief in your life, did you?
Did you?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Then why? Why do you steal paper napkins from restaurants?
I don't steal them. I don't steal them.
You're a miser.
Stop! Get away from me! Get away from me! If you don't, I'll go crazy.
Will you please decide which handkerchief you want? There's another customer waiting.
Yes, I'd like to buy a handkerchief, please.
Yes, sir. I have one with a hand-rolled hem for $5, and here's one that's pure Irish linen and sells for $7.50.
I'll take the $7.50 one, please.
Here you are. Thank you very much. And now, what about you, sporty? What? Have you made up your mind yet? You know I close at midnight.
Give me just another minute. I'll decide.
25 or 10 cents.
Those voices, stop! Stop, I'll go mad, I tell you. Mad. Do you hear me? Mad.
He's not as good as Betty Davis. Not as good as Betty Davis.
How did that get in there? Say, clerk. Clerk, I made up my mind. Give me that quarter handkerchief.
No, Jack. You want the 10 cent one.
The quarter one.
The 10 cent one.
The quarter one.
The 10 cent one.
All right. All right, give me that 10 cent one. I'll take it. I'll take it. I knew this would happen to me. I knew it. Oh, Don.
Yes, Jack.
I was just thinking. You know, there might be something to that split personality thing after all. You know, maybe there is such a thing as a person having two sides.
Oh, you believe it now, huh? What happened in that store?
Oh, nothing. Nothing.
Could you have made a living as a fiddler?
Mm-hmm. If I had loved the violin when I was a little kid, as I do now, I could have been a fine violinist. The reason I say that, and don't hesitate to say it, is because when I decided to give concerts 10 years ago or 12 years ago, I couldn't play anything. And I had to pick up like a beginner. And before I knew it, before 8 months was over, I was playing in Carnegie Hall. I gave a concert with your Toronto Symphony.
Yeah, but are you really playing for real?
Yes. When I give a concert, I play as well as I can. When I do here, I play as well as I can.
I think most people go expecting you to pull some boo-boos.
Well, if I pull boo-boos, it's because I can't help myself, and that's what makes it funny. If I deliberately tried, it wouldn't be funny. Oh, I do on television sometimes. I'll try and play lousy for a certain reason, you see. But when I give a concert, I play big, heavy numbers, and I can't play them as well as a concert artist, a legitimate concert artist. But the humor is that I do try to play it that well, and that's what's funny.
But you've squeezed a lot of laughs out of
that
fiddle.
That's right. Now, had I started, if I had been forced to practice, like Heifetz, like Stern, like Milstein, no kid likes to practice. They had to be forced, made to practice. If I had someone that could make me practice, when I was 6 years old, 7 years old, I would never have been a comedian, and I might have been a great violinist. But you see, I got the best of it now, because now I can still give concerts with the same concert orchestras, the same famous conductor. I just gave one in London with the London Philharmonic, with a great conductor, and still give legitimate concerts and still get laughs and be the comedian, and then do it for charity.
Do you enjoy playing with the symphony orchestra?
Oh, I'd rather do that than what you see me do here.
Really?
That's my favorite bit of entertainment, concerts, for which I don't get a dime.
You know, going back to those old radio days, as we say, you worked that fiddle for laughs, and I'm thinking of, Professor LeBlanc.
Oh, yeah, my violin teacher. Mel Blanc used to play that, you know.
Marvelously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, those were funny shows.
I keep telling you, not that way.
But, Professor, I've done so many exercises, I'd rather play something like Souvenir.
Maybe later, but right now, let us get back to the exercises. And this time I will count for you.
Yes, sir.
One and two and three and four and... Watch the notes that you are striking. Bend your thumb, you're not hitchhiking. Lay the notes a little thinner. I don't want to lose my dinner. I am sorry I left Paris. You are even worse than Harris. Oh, Monsieur Benny, how long have you been playing the violin?
Oh, I've played the violin since I was a little baby.
A little baby?
Yes, in fact, if you look closely at my violin, you can see my teeth marked.
Monsieur Benny, after hearing you play, those could be anybody's.
Now, wait a minute. I'm paying you to teach me, not to insult me. If I'm not playing so well today, maybe it's because my fingernails are too long.
Long fingernails have nothing to do with it.
Well, your fingernails are short.
They were long when I came in here.
And stop spitting them on the rug. For heaven's sake, I'll try it again.
Please. And this time, just follow these simple instructions. Relax, be calm, and slide the bow delicately over the strings.
Is that all?
That is all. Now commence. One, two. You see, it sounds better already.
They're fixing the string. I'll try it once more.
No. Let us call it a day. The lesson she has done.
Tut, Professor. Look at the clock. The lesson still has 14 seconds to go.
14 seconds.
That's right.
And then you will give me back my pants?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Commence. The bell, the alarm clock, the hour she is up, the lesson she is finished. I am liberated. Free! Free! Hello, the monde, la patrie!
Professor LeBlanc, control yourself. Control yourself and stop kissing me. Goodness, these Frenchmen are so emotional.
Forgive me, Monsieur Benny. I forgot myself.
Well, Professor, the lesson is over. You may go now.
But, Monsieur, you have forgotten something. You have not paid me.
Oh, yes. By the way, Professor, would you like some lunch?
No, I want the money this time.
Well, I'll have to get it for you. Excuse me a minute.
Your style in broadcasting was not so much political commentary or current commentary.
No.
It was family.
Yeah.
You created a family of people, and
the
humor was personal. And I think that was a great reason for your success, that people knew Rochester, and they knew Don
That's
Wilson,
right.
and they knew Phil Harris.
And Dennis Day, Mary.
Was that your idea?
Well, it developed. It just developed. Wasn't my idea when I first went on, exactly. I didn't know what was going to happen. Just developed, that's all.
Is this the way your career's been, just evolving?
That's right. Now take the feud that I had with Fred Allen. Supposing Fred Allen and I had gotten together and said, let's have a feud. You know how long that would have lasted? About 8 minutes. Yeah. In about a month, the feud would die. But we didn't. The feud just started. And he picked it up, and I picked it up. We were in that feud for 8 months before we even discussed it with each other.
How did the feud come about?
By my playing a fiddle and him making derogatory remarks about it. Then I followed it, and then he followed it, and the first thing you know, we had a real feud going.
Had you known him very well prior to
that? Oh, sure. We've been friends for years. He was probably the only real wit that I could have had a successful feud with. Maybe Bob Hope or George Burns. Those would have been the only other two.
But it was the disparity between the two styles that allowed the feud. Because he was almost intellectual.
And not only that. He was a brilliant writer. He's a great wit. And he was vitriolic. He could be vitriolic. He could be acidy. You know.
But your style was such that you were never afraid to make fun of yourself, to present yourself as a dope.
No, and I was always try to be the underdog between Fred Allen and myself. Like if I got the best of him at something, I'd be elated over that, you see. But it was always funnier when Fred got the best of me.
Benny was born ignorant, and he's been losing ground ever since. Benny was doing a monologue with a pig on the stage. The pig was there to eat up the stuff the audience threw at Benny. Why, some weeks he used two pigs. Benny is the only guy in New York who has to bounce his nickels for the manager before they let him in the automat. Who would be low enough to sneak into a tour to save 60 cents?
There's the guy. Hey, you!
Who, me?
Jack, how can you be so cheap?
All right, go ahead. Be like the other radio comedians. Tell some cheap joke. I won't even eat in the sun. My shadow might ask me for a bite.
Your shadow has teeth? Jack, now look. Jack, don't get excited. Look, if you're cheap, you're cheap.
That's the way I look at it.
Well, Jack, if there ever was a time that you and I should not argue, this is the time.
What do you mean, this is the time?
Well, haven't you heard? A lot of the radio programs that have been on for many years have been canceled. By the way, you finished tonight, didn't you?
Yes, sirree. Tonight was my last show of the season.
Did your sponsor mention anything about your program coming back in October?
Well, no, Fred, but we have a mutual understanding. You see, we always sort of take it for granted.
Oh.
The season ends, the sponsor shakes hands with me, and then we... Yipe!
Jack, what's wrong?
Tonight he didn't shake hands.
Cheer up, Jack. When you're retired, you can tune in on my new show.
New show?
People don't want entertainment today. A radio show has to give away things. Nylons, iceboxes, automobiles.
You mean to stay on the air, you have to give things away?
Yes.
I'll die first.
Well, not me. I'm auditioning my new program tonight.
And Fred, you're giving things away?
Tons of stuff.
Well, Fred, as long as I'm here in the studio...
Well, no, I'm sorry, Jack. Professional... Professional people cannot participate. It's a rule.
But don't you ever find people on these programs changing their names to get something for nothing?
Well, occasionally we do catch a phony, but we're on the air. What can we do?
Now, Mr. Allen, we're ready for your audition.
I'll run along, Fred. So long.
So long, Jack.
Hmm.
giving away things for nothing.
Well, all right, let's try out my new show.
Here he is, the man who will change one of you nobodies into king for a day, the old kingmaker himself, Red Allen.
Thank you. Thank you. And here is our first eager contestant. Your name, sir?
Myron Proudfoot.
Myron Proudfoot? You look like a chap I know.
I'm not interested in your friends. Start giving things away, brother.
What is your occupation, Mr. Proudfoot?
I'm a chaplain in a bakery.
What does a chaplain do in a bakery?
I put wings on angel cakes.
How long have you been in the cake business, Mr. Proudfoot?
Long enough to know a crumb when I see one. I see one.
Don't get sarcastic, Mr. Proudleg.
The name is Proudfoot, and make with the question.
All right. Who was the sixth president of the United States?
John Quincy Adams.
John Quincy Adams is correct, and Mr. Myron Proudfoot is king for a day. Well, Your Majesty...
What do I get?
Immediately after this program, Your Majesty will be guest of honor at a banquet at Hamburger Heaven. Tomorrow morning, through the courtesy of the sanitation department, you will be guest conductor on the 11-5 garbage run through the Bronx. At night, in your ermine robe, you will be whisked by bicycle to Orange, New Jersey, where you will be the judge in a chicken cleaning contest.
I'm king for a day!
Not all.
There's more?
Yes, we are going to start right now to make you look like a king. Your suit is a little baggy, King. Boys, take His Majesty's coat off.
Wait.
On our stage, we have a Hoffman pressing machine.
Now, wait a minute.
An expert operating the Hoffman pressing machine will press your trousers.
Now, wait a minute. Give me my pants.
Quiet, King.
Alan, this is a place. Where are my pants?
Denny, for 15 years I've been waiting to catch you like
Alan,
this.
Alan, you haven't seen the end of me.
It won't be long now.
I want my pants.
I have great respect for writers because I used to always give them a lot of publicity. But most writers are good that write for radio and television. Where they have problems, if the star himself does or herself doesn't know what he or she wants, then no writers are good enough. You see, you take Lucille Ball, she knows what she wants. Her writers know what she won't accept. Now, the same with me. Same with George Burns when he used to work with Gracie, you know. Now, I can take almost any 2, 3, or 4 writers. I mean, they can't be lousy, but let's say they're fairly good writers. And in a very short time, mold them into what I want.
You were the guiding force, but
you have
those
to be.
Scripts.
If you're not, you're in trouble. Very few fellas. It would be a very unusual thing. Unless it's a play that's written, you know. Fellow writes a play. Now, I have one writer who's with me all the time. He's my head writer, Hilliard Marks. He's here. Now, he'll write for me all the time. We sit every day, we write for something, because I look at a schedule, I've always got something coming up. And he and I write together. And he's a marvelous writer.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's go out and visit Jack Benny at his home in Beverly Hills, where at the moment we find Rochester trimming his hair.
Just a little more off the sides, Rochester.
Yes, sir.
You know, Rochester, it may sound funny, but when I was just a little kid, I had the most beautiful head of thick golden curls.
You did, boss?
Yeah. In fact, my mother was so proud of them that she gave a curl to every one of our relatives.
Well, you better write to them, boss. It's time to get them back.
Yeah. Hold it, Rochester. How much have you trimmed off the sides?
Almost a handful.
Good. Now sprinkle it around the top. Thanks. What are you laughing at?
This ain't no haircut. It's a landscaping job.
Well, it's a little trick I learned in agriculture school. Good old fertilizer tech. How are you doing?
I'm nearly finished.
Good. How does my hair look?
Fine, boss. You want to put it on now?
Yes, hold the mirror for me, please. You know, Rochester, I can't understand how the hair on a toupee can grow.
The ones you buy stay the same, but this is one of those you trapped yourself.
Well, I only trapped a few.
Yeah, but you better get rid of that one with the white stripe down the middle. You're losing all your friends.
Yeah. Now, Rochester, will you please brush the hair off my neck?
Okay.
I'll open my shirt first. Yeah.
Say, boss, why do you wear that penny around your neck on a string?
It's for sentimental reasons, Rochester. This is the first penny I ever owned.
Oh.
And you know that dollar I have framed in my bedroom?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first dollar I ever owned.
Oh.
And you know that picture by Maxwell that hangs in the den? That's the first car I ever owned.
That's the first car anybody ever owned.
What?
That car scared more horses than the meat shortage.
No, I don't know.
Say, boss, you want me to get a clean shirt for you to wear down the studio?
Huh?
You didn't forget your broadcast, did you?
How could I forget? The broadcast, always the broadcast. Year after year. Every Monday, I think of ideas. Tuesday, I meet with my writers. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, we write. Saturday, I rehearse. And on Sunday, I do my program, and one short half hour, it's all over. All that work for just one half hour. And for what, I ask? For what?
For a lousy $1 million.
No, Rochester, you have the wrong slant on life. Money isn't everything.
Boss, wake up. Wake up.
I am awake. And I meant what I said. You know, Rochester, there's an old saying that the best things in life are free.
Uh-huh.
Money is not everything.
Uh-huh.
Look out that window. Look at the sunshine, the fresh air, the birds, the trees, the blossoms. Right down the street, you can see. Hey, here comes the mailman. Wonder if he brought my salary check today. I hope so.
What happened to the birds and the sunshine?
Looks like rain, doesn't it, Roger? Oh, mailman! Oh, mailman!
What do you do besides show business? I've never heard.
Well, I don't do much of anything, except that I suddenly had great love for the violin the last 10, 12 years, and I'll practice a lot now. This is my hobby. My hobby now is to practice, and I'll practice sometimes an hour, two, or three a day, and I'll play golf, and I'm a lousy golfer, but I'll play, and I enjoy it. And outside of show business, that's about the only two things that I do. I love to travel. I love to travel by automobile a lot. I used to do that a lot. I used to travel across the country. My vacation used to be going from here to New York and back and things like that by automobile and be alone or, I mean, with one other person, another fella. There's nothing else. I have no other hobby. It's difficult to call the violin. You can't call golf a hobby. That's not a hobby. You know,
a little recreation.
Yeah, that's all. But violin could be a hobby. You see, because I would love to be a real fine violinist if I could, but it's too late now. So I practice to be as good as I can.
Speaking of automobiles, have you ever in your life driven a Maxwell?
I may have, but I don't remember.
You don't remember.
The Maxwell, the word Maxwell came out of any car we would have used as a gag. Could have been an old Stutz, or it could have been any of the old name cars. Could have been anything. And we just happened to pick Maxwell, and that's the name that stuck.
And our old friend.
Just like Love and Bloom, my theme song. Is a number I used to fool with on the fiddle, you see? Now, any number that I would have fooled with in the fiddle, with the fiddle at that time, would have become my theme song, whether I wanted it or not.
Identification.
That's because I would never pick Love and Bloom in a million years.
I've often wondered how it came to be
associated
with it.
That's it, because I'd go places and then I'd hear the orchestras playing it for me. That means that I fooled around with it so much that it became my theme song. You couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop it today if I wanted to.
There's another funny thing about your career, and it sounds odd when you mention it, but you got your start in broadcasting on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, most people have forgotten that he had a radio show.
That's true, though. He did a radio show of news and sports, and once he asked me to be a guest on it. And this was after I had quit the show in order to try to get on radio. And I got on it, and we prepared a couple of gags together. And by God, an agency heard me for Canada Dry Ginger Ale, gave me a job. Got through Ed Sullivan.
And that was 1932.
Yeah. Now, I probably would have got on anyway, but I still have to credit Sullivan with the start.
When you look back on it all, it's been a pretty good life.
Oh, yes. Yes, I must say. Now, I've had a lot of little worries in my life, but those are things that you bring on yourself. I really have had, and I certainly have had no health problems, no marriage problems. When someone says to me, how would you like to be 39 again? I say, no, sir. Only if I felt as good as I feel now. Why should I go back and put myself in a position with all the things that can happen to people today, overnight, when here I am at my age and have escaped all of that? Why go back? I've been very fortunate, very lucky. Sure, my big fault is I've been very moody. I've been moody in my life. But that's something I couldn't explain. If you asked me why, I couldn't tell you. Because in 2 hours later, I'd feel like $1 million.
Were you glad that you were born at the time you were in history?
Who knows? Now, let me ask this. People say to me, aren't you glad now that you didn't take the violin seriously? How do I know? Maybe I'd have been very happy being a great violinist. And I think I could have been. But it turned out so that both, I got the benefit of both.
You know, you could say you're a comedian, and yet you're not a comedian. You're sort of a comic actor.
Yeah, I'm more of an actor, I think, than a comedian. Gleason is. Jackie Gleason is probably the best acting comedian we have in the business. Bob Hope is better as a monologist.
Tell me, has humor changed very much in your lifetime? Or is humor basic?
I think humor is basic. I think you've gotten to the point, like everything has changed, where you can be a little more risque. You see, I can do a lot of things there I wouldn't do on television. You know, on the stage. Not only here, but in any theater. But when I do risque material, I try to find a reason for it instead of doing it just to reach the risque part. There's a reason for my saying something. If I say something is risque, it could have something to do because I think a thing is too expensive, or I think, and it leads into something risque. I never try to tell a risque gag just for the fact that it's risque, unless it has a good basic reason, sometimes a basic truth. You know the one I told about finding the little pad along the pool?
The half of a brassiere.
Yeah, that actually happened. And that's how we got the joke. That actually happened. Women were laughing. I looked down, there it was. Because you wouldn't make up a joke like that. You couldn't, you know. A lot of jokes are done that way, or come from a basic truth.
They're drawn from everyday life.
That's right. You take a thing like that, now you try to find, oh, this particular gag, this writer that I tell you about gave it to me. He picked it up and he said, I don't know if a woman lost this or there's a rabbi missing. Now you gotta look down, you get the whole picture looking down the pool and see if there's a rabbi down there. And a rabbi, what's so ridiculous, a rabbi wouldn't actually be wearing that at a pool, you know.
Yeah. But has it been a purpose of yours to observe humanity to get your humor? Do you study people? Have you done that?
I must have, I guess. I don't say that I just studied them. But I wrote a whole routine once about the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. just by sitting there watching a show once. And I wrote a whole routine that ran about 2 minutes. Now, that's a long time, you know. It doesn't sound long when you say 2 minutes, but you just sit here and wait for 2 minutes. You see how long it is. All about the hotel, just by sitting there, going through the lobby and watching the rooms and watching the people and everything.
Observing.
Observing, that's right.
Tell me, what kind of a background did you come from? It's always interesting to ask
a
comedian
that.
No, not a
show business background at all.
You always look for reasons for people.
Yeah, you look for reasons and you can't figure it out. My sister would have never been in show business. I just have the one sister. My father and mother were never in show business. They liked music. My mother played piano a little bit. They would have liked. The sad part of my life has only been, you see, my father did live to see me become somebody in radio, a big star in radio. He never lived to see it in television, but he lived to see something happen. My mother never did. My mother died before I had reached any of importance. And she was disappointed because she expected me to be a violin soloist, you know.
Did your father live long enough to see a high school in Waukegan named after you?
No. My father never lived to see this school named after me.
How does it feel when you hear someone going to Jack Benny High?
Yeah, they call it the 39ers. You know? I go there once in a while and I hand out the diplomas. And so it's very funny to me when the personnel who work there, when they answer the phone, "Hello, Jack Benny," which means Jack Benny High, you know, and I stand and I listen to it, you know. It's a beautiful school, very modern, you know.
You've given Waukegan a lot of play.
Well, you see, you can do it with a small town. You can't do it if you're born in Chicago. I was actually born in Chicago at the Mercy Hospital, but my mother carried me in Waukegan. You see, we lived in Waukegan. She only went to Chicago to give birth to me. It was all to the hospital.
You would... some while back mentioning being in the U.S. Navy First World War. Had you done anything prior to that?
Yes. I did a fiddle act, violin and piano act in show business.
You must have been very young then.
Yeah, I was just a kid then.
So you always wanted to do this kind of lark?
Yeah. I was brought into it by a woman who used to do what they call piano logs. She used to sing and talk at the piano. And she took me along. I was just a kid and gave me a little salary. And I played violin. We did a violin piano act. But this did not please my mother. My mother wanted me to be a soloist. But my mother and father never jumped on me, never made me do it. And that's the only way. That's the only way anybody becomes good. Heifetz's child life was just awful.
Benny is your first name, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, that's right. And the way I used Benny for a last name was that when this woman brought me in show business, the act was called Salisbury and Benny. And so when I went out on my own, even though Benny was my first name, I used it so much that I had to use it as a last name. And I had to find something to go with it. And Jack, I figure, went with anything. I didn't like when I first saw the name Jack Benny. It seemed ridiculous.
Tell me, why are so many great comedians and humorists Jewish, particularly in America?
I think what it has to do with, I think it's been persecution. And the thing that's kept Jews going was the fact you had to have a sense of humor almost to exist. And some of the great actors, some of the great musicians, look what's happened in Germany, the great doctors, great scientists. Look what we've lost in science because of Hitler, who killed off 6 million. We might have had a cure a long time ago for cancer. And Hitler killed all of that. There were so many that were just killed that could have, young people.
But humor does come out of suffering.
I think a lot of it does. I think kids that are born very wealthy for some reason or other, it isn't always conducive to to good comedy. Or you take, I never advocate a college. Am I right in advocating a college education for people who are going to be in show business? I think if they go to high school, that's enough. I'd say if you went through high school, and most of them didn't. I didn't at all. I just went through public school. I lost a lot. And I miss it, too. I miss a good schooling. I miss a lot. And when people say to me, well, how much better could you do? Well, that's a silly question, because I could still do as well and still enjoy more of what I read and what I see, and my concentration would be better and everything. Just the fact that I've been successful doesn't mean that I couldn't be anyway. And then maybe again I couldn't have been.
You never know.
You never know. So I just have to be satisfied and just shut up.
I think we can say you made it.
I guess I made it. But I still go back to what we were first discussing. The hell with the past. It's today and what's going to happen, as long as I'm working.